case for argument is Thompson v. Battaglia. Mr. Kuhlman. This might help him a lot in terms of the Department of Justice.
May it please the court. Petitioner Dennis Thompson Jr. was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison without the basic safeguard of adequate representation. Thompson's trial counsel, Frank Rago, committed legion errors during Thompson's trial. I'm going to focus on a single central error today. Namely, Rago relied on a mental state defense. It failed to put on any mental state evidence.
I'd like to ask you something about that. Thompson's mental state defense seems like a modified version of a battered spouse defense. Does Illinois law allow such a defense for an adult who has been abused as a child?
It's our position that there's no category recognizing that type of a defense, but we think that the second degree murder statute there's only four categories, recognized categories, but those are not exclusive categories, and battered son or battered child theory, I think, fits within the language of that statute.
But I had a very similar question, because it certainly seems, well, two things. It seems to me, looking at what the Illinois Supreme Court said in People versus Garcia, makes it sound like four categories. And even looking beyond that to other Illinois cases, I don't see this recognized yet. So that's point one. Point two is, particularly through the lens of AEDPA and habeas review, I'm not sure this court is the one to instruct the Illinois courts as to what Illinois state law would have accepted as a provocation defense. I understand your opponents to be saying, even if all the evidence that you would like to have seen had come in, it really is a matter of law, would not have made a difference to the first versus second degree murder point.
Yeah, okay, and I think there's sort of two separate aspects to your question. First, there's sort of what is Illinois law say, and then there's, on top of that, there's the federalism dynamic.
Right. I mean, can we tell the Illinois courts they got Illinois law wrong by not recognizing a category beyond the four in Garcia?
Right. And I'll start with it. You know, I think Illinois law, it's patently clear that there are not these four traditional, you know, that second-degree murder is not limited to those particular four categories. The language of the statute doesn't say anything about four categories. We've cited in our brief, numerous cases that don't fall within the letter of those four categories. I'd sort of pose a hypothetical to you. I don't have any children, but if I had a child and I walked in and saw my child being molested by someone.
Yeah, but of course, this is very, very different. He didn't see anything. And then he goes and gets a gun. What is he doing with a gun?
Had Thompson's right to testify not been denied, he would have testified. And you're right to seize on that fact, Your Honor, because one of the things that the district that the state court seemed to have, and their opinions are very nebulous, and it's sort of hard to discern what the exact reasoning is, but I think one fair reading would be that they're suggesting there's an element of premeditation. Well, Thompson would have testified that he always carried a gun for protection. He had a job, but it was a job in a dangerous area, and he needed that gun for protection. He certainly didn't take a gun over to his father's house with the intent of shooting his father.
But he wasn't going into work in a dangerous neighborhood when he shot the father and the girlfriend and shooting her. How does that fit a provocation defense?
Right. Well, it's important, and
It's more you just go wild and kill a bunch of people and say you because you were provoked by one, you get a provocation defense for all.
Right. No, but we don't have that factual situation here and
oh, but we do, because I mean, how did Rouse provoke the defendant? I mean, it seems to me that even if his father provoked him, he's still liable for Rouse's death and would presumably end up with the same sentence. So,
right. Well, but it's
you've got to answer that, I think.
Right. No. You're right. We need to. You know, we do need to address.
Yeah.
Address both the murders. It's important to remember that Rouse walks in, and the record is a little unclear on this, given that Attorney Rago actually put on no defense and didn't test the state's theory. It's unclear exactly how the events transpired, but the best reading of the record as it exists is that Thompson shot his father, and just moments later, Rouse came in an agitated state. And it's our position that the mental state, the sudden and intense passion, you know, can last more than the millisecond it took to pull the trigger. There's some time after there.
But Mr. Coleman, what you just said reminded me of a general problem, not just with this case, actually, but with a lot of cases. You just referred to what's in the record, and I wondered if you, at least, have had the opportunity to read this trial transcript that doesn't seem to be here.
I have had the opportunity, yes. My client provided me with the
copy. Okay, so it exists somewhere out there in the world,
It does.
In the courts, okay.
It does, though it's not in. It wasn't made a part of the district court record, and it's obviously not.
Had it been reduced to written form at the time the district court here had the habeas petition?
Yes, and in fact, my client actually wrote a letter to the court asking, and I forget the exact language, but the gist of the letter was, you know, how do I get this to the court so the court can look at this while it's making the decision?
Then I can ask you this question. Did the trial court engage in any colloquy with Thompson at trial about whether he wished to testify?
No, there was
none.
No.
Okay.
Well, now, how do you deal with the argument that with this right to testify business that in every case in which a defendant didn't testify, which is most cases, afterwards he could say, oh, I wanted to testify and my lawyer didn't let me?
Yeah, well, I'll start with the general response, and that's, you know, constitutional protections make a lot of work for courts and make a lot of work for the justice system.
That's a really bad response.
Well, I've got a particular response as well. And I mean, I think Underwood...
You never want to make us seem like we're lazy.
No, and I certainly didn't mean to impute that. Underwood sort of strikes a middle ground, and I think Underwood actually goes a little bit farther in sort of requiring a heightened pleading standard. You can't just say...
What is the middle ground now you're advocating?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What is the middle ground you're advocating?
I think, frankly, the harmless error rule, which this court has applied, and I don't know that I'm sure the Supreme Court hasn't addressed whether there's a harmless error application to the right to testify, whether that's a structural error or whether that's just something else that is subjected to a harmless error rule. I mean, if a district court is presented with a petition where all there is someone saying, you know, I wanted to testify and there's nothing more and I was denied my right to testify, all the district court has to do is say, you know, assuming arguendo, your right to testify was denied, there's no error here.
Well, wait a second. But suppose it's not that clear. So what sort of evidentiary hearing is the judge supposed to have, to hold? I mean, you don't want to say that, well, we can grant rights promiscuously because harmless error will wash them all out. That won't happen every time.
Right. No, but
you don't say this is a harmless error case.
No, I mean, our position is that the state has waived the harmless error argument. And even if the state hadn't waived the harmless error.
Right, so you don't think that all these cases get decided.
No, meritorious.
So no, I don't know why you mentioned harmless error. What should the judge do when he's faced with this, you know, affidavit says by the defendant says, yeah, I wanted to testify. Now what does the judge do?
Well, I mean, first the judge, you know, first there has to be something in the pleadings that shows that, you know, shows that the testimony would have made a difference.
Well, I thought you were arguing that something like the middle ground we described in Underwood is actually of constitutional dimension, and maybe there's some kind of corroboration requirement that applies to that sort of statement in a defendant's affidavit. Maybe the lawyer has to say, you know, I advised him not to testify or something. That there has to be some circumstantial way of showing that indeed it wasn't just this, you know, 2020 hindsight, you know, oh good, maybe I'll try this argument problem that courts have been reluctant to, because it's really not possible, again, at habeas, for us to say that there is a constitutional law rule that requires both state and federal judges to advise defendants on the record of this right and to engage in some colloquy, because the Supreme Court of the United States has never gone that far. And as the state points out in
right.
its supplemental authority filing, the Supreme Court, indeed, for habeas, has just reminded the Ninth Circuit once again, you know, that when there are conflicts in the circuits, you can't say something is so well established that you can grant habeas on it.
Sure, and I think there's a couple of points that I'd like to respond to. I'm in there first, and I think I did get sidetracked earlier there when I was sort of discussing what I personally thought was the best way to deal with the situation of balancing constitutional rights against the sort of floodgates argument. And my position was, you know, I think Underwood went a little bit farther, but than needed to be, that Underwood perhaps gave a little extra weight to the floodgates problem, but I think, Your Honor, you're exactly right that Underwood does provide, you know, Underwood does establish a constitutional rule, and that's the constitutional rule for the circuit. And I would say that to your second point, which is, well, as I take the state's position to be, well, you know, let's take a vote. There's this many circuits that say it's this way. There's this many circuits that say it that way. So it can't be.
And so how can it be clearly established by the Supreme Court of the United States? Your brief kind of falls off the tracks when you get to this argument, because you're only citing Court of Appeals cases to us, which might like it, we're there, and that's not what we're supposed to.
I guess I'd respectfully disagree in that. I mean, we cite two elementary fundamental rules of constitutional law. One, that a defendant has a constitutional right to testify in his own defense.
Right.
Second, that fundamental rights can only be waived by there must be a knowing and intelligent waiver of fundamental constitutional rights. And it's our position that it follows inexorably from those two rules that silence doesn't equal waiver. And
but
it's our
where does the middle ground come from?
That's my take on...
What is your middle ground? I never did figure that out. You got sidetracked on harmless error. What is your middle ground now?
Well, actually, I'll just say, you know, I mean, what I think, I guess, ultimately is pretty irrelevant, but I think Underwood establishes the constitutional rule for this.
Don't tell me what you think is pretty irrelevant. What is your middle ground? You said you had a middle ground that would protect the courts from having to have an evidentiary hearing in every single case. So what is your middle ground? Or if you don't have one, you just say you don't have one.
Right. Well, I guess I'll just answer. Underwood says that the middle ground, Underwood establishes a middle ground. There's a heightened pleading requirement. I believe, in this case, Thompson's met the heightened pleading requirement.
What is the heightened pleading requirement?
It's you know, it's something of a and I forget the exact language from Underwood, but I believe it requires some particularity. There must be something more than a self-serving affidavit that just says, I wanted to testify. Here,
it's essentially a corroboration rule. I mean, really, it's got to be more than just your word for it. That's what Underwood says. I mean, it gives some examples. Maybe it doesn't quite phrase it that way, but it gives examples.
Right, and it's our position that a detailed account of the circumstances of the denial of the right to testify, along with a detailed explanation of what the petitioner would have testified about,
but that's is sufficient. Not, so you can't have self-corroboration, can you?
Yeah, I think any other sort of corroboration requirement would really eviscerate the right, because you would be asking, you have an attorney who is in violation of his professional responsibilities, violated his client's right to testify in his own defense. You're going to expect that attorney to come out and readily grant an affidavit and say, sure, if he wanted to testify, I wouldn't let him.
You might want to say
thanks.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Coleman. Ms. Myers?
Good morning. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Leah Myers from the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of Respondent Warden Deirdre Battaglia. A Certificate of Appealability, or CA, was granted on two grounds in this case: whether defense counsel was ineffective for failing to obtain a mental health examination and present evidence about petitioner's mental state at the time of the shootings, and secondly, whether petitioner was denied his Sixth Amendment right to testify. Petitioner is not entitled to relief on either ground. As an initial matter, it should be briefly noted that petitioner also includes three additional issues in his briefs. However, these are beyond the CA as it currently exists. When petitioner filed a motion for CA before this court, he listed several issues and argued an argument about those issues, which this court considered each of these independent claims, which at that time included the two issues in the CA and these three additional issues from the brief.
You know, I'd like to take up Mr. Kuhlman's last point first.
Sure.
Because right now, Thompson's only evidence that his attorney refused to let him testify is his own affidavit. And without a hearing, how can he be expected to produce any evidence beyond that? I mean, none of us seriously expect, as Mr. Coleman noted, his attorney to sign an affidavit stating, look, my client wanted to testify. I absolutely refuse to let him testify against his own wishes.
Well, in Underwood, this court balanced those concerns and gave an example of what petitioner could give as the attorney's affidavit. While that might be hard to obtain, that is what is balanced against the fact that any petitioner could speak up, write an affidavit, and claim that he wanted to testify. There is a need for more evidence so that these claims are not too numerous to handle. In addition, it is true that the United States Supreme Court has not addressed this particular issue, and Kane has made clear that the general cites by petitioner to the constitutional rights and that waiver must be knowing and voluntary is inadequate under Section 2254 D1 because it does not address this particular issue. And because there is no United States Supreme Court precedent, while of course Underwood is persuasive, it is not United States Supreme Court precedent.
If we allow silence to serve as conclusive evidence of a waiver of a right to testify, how is that consistent with the fundamental nature of that right? I mean, wouldn't the easiest way to protect that right be to engage in a colloquy with the defendant during trial, like we do in federal courts? That would only take a moment, truly only a moment, and all the parties would already be present. I mean, what is the downside here?
Well, the problem, Your Honor, potentially would be that it's the court stepping into the role of the attorney. It's more appropriate to assume that the attorney properly discussed the right to testify with his client and that by his silence at trial that can be validly construed.
So we're doing it wrong in federal court. We do it wrong.
No, it's just that because the United States Supreme Court has not imposed that requirement, it's unfair to retroactively criticize the Illinois Appellate Court for not having done that
case. Yeah, that's a very different answer than the one you just gave to Judge Rovner, because, in fact, what you said makes every single Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 11 colloquy also intruding into the role of the attorney, because the judge tells the defendant, you're giving up the right to testify in your own defense, you're giving up the right to a jury, you're giving up this right, you're giving up that right. And it's the judge who's telling the defendant that. I mean, I should think the only point you could suggest is the one that you have said, which is that the Supreme Court at this level of particularity hasn't gone there. But I have to say I'm a little troubled by your reliance on just counting noses with Cain. If you imagined, you know, that there was a split in the circuits, and one circuit said silence equals waiver, and another circuit said we need some evidence that the waiver was knowing and voluntary, aside from just sitting there, and was concerned about the intimidation factor and all the rest of the, you know, grandeur of the courtroom setting. If it was the three most, you know, out and three craziest federal appellate judges in the country who had said, I'm sure we all have our favorite list, right? But who had said that silence is waiver, that, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that any particular decision was a correct decision or even one that you might accept as well-reasoned. We need to do more than count noses, in other words. And Cain was a situation where the right of self-representation had never gone all the way down to law library access, but maybe ours is a different matter.
Well, it's important to remember the perspective of habeas, which we are in here, which is whether the Illinois Appellate Court correctly made a correct decision about this issue. And so while it's true that the most persuasive reason is not a head count of the different circuits, it was merely cited by respondent as additional persuasive authority for the fact that the Illinois Appellate Court's decision is consistent with this court's interpretation in Underwood and the fact that there is no United States Supreme Court precedent directly on point.
Suppose the trial judge had said, I mean, I of course have not seen this transcript, and I find it very hard to make a Strickland prejudice assessment without having any idea of the context in which I'm trying to assess prejudice, but be that as it may, suppose the trial judge had said at an early point in the trial when the defendant tried to speak up, I'm not going to tolerate any outbursts from you. You must stay quiet, and you are represented by counsel, so you may speak only through your lawyer. Isn't it a little unfair to expect the defendant then to pop up later on in the trial and say, hello, you know, I actually really want to testify?
Well, that hypothetical does raise concerns, but that's not the case that we have here.
So the judge didn't. Well, but judges often do admonish defendants to be quiet in the courtroom because some defendants don't behave themselves well.
Well, that may be true in general. However, because of the fact that that petitioner had the opportunity when it was the defense case to have testified.
How did he have that opportunity without standing up himself and somehow disrupting the proceedings?
Well, because of the fact that the record does not show that happened.
Because we've never seen the transcript.
That's true. The district court decided that it was not necessary to consider the transcripts.
And how would you, if you were trying to assess the prejudice prong of a Strickland versus Washington analysis, assess prejudice without knowing what happened at the trial, when you didn't know what did the trial judge say, when you didn't know whether cross-examination looked perfunctory or well-informed, when you didn't know anything? How can we do that?
Well, in this particular case, the type of ineffective assistance that is before this court is a matter of whether first-degree murder could have been mitigated to second-degree murder. And the reason it cannot succeed is a matter of Illinois law, which can be seen in the circumstances that are contained in the record. It is not necessary to look at the extent of cross-examination because there simply was no serious provocation as a matter of Illinois law. And without that, the result could not have been
different. Well, it seems to me, though, the Illinois courts themselves fall back on the overwhelming evidence. The district court talks about that. There's a lot of evidentiary assessment going on that we have absolutely no way of satisfying ourselves that was done the right way.
That's true. It's often true in habeas cases that...
And I'm often concerned in habeas cases about this. If you have a pure question of law, which I think you're saying part of this is, if that's all we had before us, may be true that there's no need for a trial transcript. But when you're talking about harmless error, when you're talking about prejudice, could it have affected the outcome? I don't see how we can do anything in the absence of the trial transcript.
Well, however, given the presumption of correctness to facts in 2254E1, it is appropriate to rely on the facts as shown in the
appellate
court.
But it's not an irrebuttable presumption of correctness.
That's true.
And so how can I...
Well, in this case,
even if there's a 1% chance left without the trial transcript, how can I assess it?
Well, that's true, but petitioner has not challenged the findings of facts. He has not raised the findings, the factual...
He's challenging the prejudice assessment.
Oh, yes.
That's true. However, in this case, it is a question of law, so that the transcripts are not essential in this particular case.
What meaningful challenge to the charges did Thompson's lawyer present at trial? I mean, he seems to have conceded that his client killed the two victims. What evidence did he present of serious provocation? If there was no such evidence, as you argued in the brief, then was this really a defense at all?
Well, defense counsel did put forth four defense witnesses who were members of petitioner's family, who all put forth evidence about the history of abuse of petitioner. While it may not have been, as a matter of law, sufficient serious provocation, that's the best he had in this case, given the fact the petitioner confessed, given the fact that he pointed police to the gun, given the fact that the defense counsel did the best he could with what there was. And because of the fact that there wasn't a better defense, we shouldn't fault defense counsel. Because, in fact, he did put on four defense witnesses. He cross-examined state's witnesses. He also made several motions. This shows that he was active and that any allegation of ineffectiveness by petitioner is only pointing to specific omissions and should not be evaluated under chronic, as petitioner puts forth in his brief, because there was not an entire failure to subject the prosecution's case to adversarial testing. In fact, I'd like to briefly address the fact that petitioner cited several cases for the idea that there are more than four categories of serious provocation under Illinois law. However, none of his citations should be so regarded. For example, first, this court's case of Davis versus Lambert does put a factual summary within it that included a mitigation to second-degree murder. However, that was not the issue of this case that was examined by this court. In addition, the underlying appellate court decisions for that case were unpublished. Therefore, there is no precedential value to any factual summary in that case. Secondly, there is the 1992 Illinois appellate court case of People versus Petrusel. But in that case, the allegations were whether the fact the victim slapped the offender's wife and the fact the victim made threatening statements to the offender was sufficient mitigation. However, in that case, the appellate court upheld the trial court's refusal to mitigate, which merely shows that those circumstances do not fall within the four circumstances. And again, respondent would point to the case indicated by Your Honor that People versus Garcia in 1995 closed any confusion because the remaining cases cited by petitioner all occurred in the 1970s prior to the Illinois Supreme Court clarifying that there are only four categories of serious provocation. In addition, the circumstances of this case cannot be fit within the four categories. Specifically, petitioner points to three circumstances. Specifically, that the victim, Dennis Thompson Sr., who is petitioner's father, who I'll refer to as Sr., that Sr. Beat petitioner's stepmother the night before, Sr.'s imminent adulterous conduct with the other victim, Don Renee Rouse, and Sr.'s history of abusing petitioner.
Can you answer the question Judge Rovner asked at the outset, the extent to which, if at all, Illinois recognized any kind of battered relative, I'll say, spouse or other consideration, whether for guilt or level or sentencing or anything?
Certainly. I can't say with confidence throughout Illinois law where it relies, but I do know that within the specific type of second-degree murder, there are only the four categories
that we have
discussed.
Right, but that's not answering my question at all. My question is, as a matter of, is there such a theory located anywhere in Illinois law?
Not to my knowledge. That's the best answer
I can give.
Illinois
has rejected all battered spouse claims.
Well, I'm not sure under other types of homicide how it's dealt with, honestly, because I only confine my research to this type of second-degree murder. But I do know within the circumstances of this case and the argument of mitigation that this argument cannot be used to mitigate first-degree murder to second-degree murder, which is what petitioner was asserting it for. So as a matter of Illinois law, that does not help him in this case within his argument. And in fact, because of the fact that the history of abuse does not specify the last time that Senior had inflicted serious injury on petitioner, the substantial physical injury category has a temporal limitation, specifically that there cannot be a cooling off period between the last reception of the injury and the responding homicide. And as a result, because it was at least a day, that it cannot fall within that category. I see that my time is about to expire, so in closing, I would merely say that for the foregoing reasons, respondent asks this court to affirm the decision of the district court, which denied habeas relief. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Myers. Mr. Kuhlman, how much time does he have? 1 minute? So, Mr. Kuhlman, in your brief, you say that the transcript, I forgot how you put it, the transcript shows in full Rago's failure to test the state's case.
Right, exactly.
But you didn't actually, refer to the transcript, did you?
Well, no, I mean, frankly, and perhaps I misunderstood the court's rules, but since it wasn't made a record, wasn't made a part of the record in the district court, I just didn't think I was at liberty.
Well, it's not evidence, though. You take judicial notice of a judicial proceeding, right? Take judicial notice of a...
You can file a motion in the district court to supplement the record with something that is, as Judge Posner is saying, a judicial document. It's not like you're asking, to put a new expert report in or something. You're asking, you could have moved to supplement and then it would have been before us.
Right. So, and perhaps I didn't think creatively enough about that. I think some of the questions during counsel's time made clear that it is the transcript is really a crucial piece of evidence.
Well, really, if it was a crucial piece of evidence, why didn't you put it before us? I mean, really, what did you think you were going to? You're going to have two appeals, one without the transcript. If you lose on that, you go back and you have an appeal based on the transcript.
No, we thought.
I mean, you didn't argue in your brief that the failure of the district judge to get the transcript was an error requiring a remand.
No, I guess I.
I mean, isn't it a little late to be arguing over the transcript?
No, I mean, what we do request is we request an evidentiary hearing before the district court. And I believe in that portion of our brief, we make clear that as part of the evidence, that we ask for an evidentiary hearing, assuming the court does not grant.
Well, what weight in our consideration of your appeal, should we give to the fact that the district judge did not demand the transcript and you haven't put it before us? What weight should we give that?
I'm sorry, I guess I just don't understand the weight.
I guess what significance should we give to the fact that there's no transcript?
Oh, sure. The significance is that it wasn't petitioner's fault for failing to make it a part of the district court record.
Well, I thought your argument was he asked, and maybe he sent
exactly
a letter to somewhat the wrong person, but his letter got lost in the shuffle or somehow or another didn't produce...
Right. What I'm trying to say is there's no fault. There was no fault on Thompson.
But you didn't say that the district court erred in failing to get the transcript, nor did you put the transcript before us. So my question is, what significance should we, in considering your appeal, give to the transcript? Should we remand because there's no transcript?
Transcript is one piece of evidence among many that the district court would hear in an evidentiary hearing. If the court is not satisfied that relief should be granted on the materials before it.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Coleman. Next case for argument, United